In June 2007, Robert Rich was touring the East Coast, and two of his concerts were in the WDIY vicinity. While at Nearfest in Bethlehem, I caught up with Robert, who granted me an interview which aired on program number 535, broadcast on June 28, 2007. I hope you enjoy it. If you do, I'd love to hear about it. Send your comments to info@wdiy.org. Here's the interview. I'm speaking with Robert Rich here at Zollner Art Center, who will be playing at Nearfest tomorrow.
Indeed, yes.
So how did you get invited to a progressive rock festival?
Well, it's not such a surprise. I've realized for years that my music doesn't really fit any simple category. I seem to slip pretty easily between, you know, ambient, dark ambient, noise, new age, electronic, space music. Why not add, you know, the progressive side of things? You know, it's all just music, and I think we all share an interest in pushing envelopes, in defining new vocabularies, in creating music that has a kind of an edge to it that takes the mind somewhere new. And so I think that there's a lot of common ground there.
That's good. What do you have planned for your set?
I'll be performing a short set, because that's the spot they gave me in the show, which is going to be based upon the film that just came out, Atlas Day. I've got a short edit of that, about 35-minute edit, and I'll be playing pieces that relate to those images in the film and a little bit freeform, things based on the albums Electric Ladder and Bestiary and other things that are just from the film soundtrack.
You did an expanded version of that last week at the Space Music Festival.
Yeah, it'll be like that, but with a slight different sequence.
Now, is there a synchronization that goes on between the music and the video?
Nothing more than my attempts at hitting the right hit points by hand. No, there's no SMPTE times code, you know, running anything.
So you're living on the edge as usual.
Well, I think it's better that way. If it's too automated, it's not really live, is it? You might
right.
as well just go see a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to make it enough in the moment that it's actually live music, which is a difficult question with electronic music as to what live really means, because a lot of the sounds come from non-real-time processes, from the mangling of acoustic sources or slowing things down, going backwards and stuff. There's only so much of that you can do live, and so you make it a juggling act between pieces that you're performing live with live instrumentation and things that you could think of as backing tracks, although in this case, like MIDI, how much is a backing track or a sequencer? How much is it running the thing you're doing? It's a continuum there.
Yeah, there's a few mailing lists I'm on who periodically revisit that very topic. So when you're playing a slide guitar or a flute, that's quite obvious. But
right.
You also have your MLTM modular with you.
Right, and that thing is wired up with MIDI control and a lot of things that are self-running voltage control. And so I just turn a knob up on the mixer on the modular synth, and a thing that's been happening all this time becomes audible because I've just turned it up. And so that sort of variation, it's totally live electronics, and I can twist a knob and it sounds different. But it's playing itself.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing about modular synthesizers is that the sound is always running. It's just how do you patch it up? And how do you modulate it and change it?
Right. In the world of the Nord modulars, some people call those noodles because they're self-running.
Well, the funny thing is that most of the virtual modulars still have the problem of being triggered by MIDI. And you don't have that self-running quality unless, you know, the very few that allow you to make that happen. The Time Warp 2600 plugin lets you make a sound as soon as you bring it up, as soon as you turn it on, but that's rare among the modeled ones. It's default in the real ones, you know. That's the way they're always doing it.
Yeah, the oscillator's always oscillating until you patch
right.
it into something to block it or to let it through.
Exactly. In fact, a modular synthesizer has the opposite metaphor of sound making than MIDI does. In MIDI, a sound is caused by an event that goes on and then goes off. With a modular synthesizer, basically, sounds are always on and you're gating them. You're turning them off when you don't want them to be heard. And that's what an envelope is. It's simply, it's a shapeable gate that you're making something audible for that moment of time. And so it's an inverse metaphor, actually. You know, you're carving away rather than adding up or triggering.
So when it's playing and you bring it the fader up so we can hear it, it's a surprise to you exactly what it's doing at that point in time.
Hopefully not a total surprise.
Well, obviously, in general, you know what to expect, but yeah. The timing just isn't locked into anything.
Right. I keep that pretty run. But it is locked in if I have it run from the computer. I mean, I've got a MIDI to CV interface. I don't know how many, we're probably boring people with geek talk here, but the computer can sit there and control the voltages on the modular, and the computer's also, at the same time, playing some of those sounds that I referred to that don't really make sense as live sounds, you know, like slowed down things or things that were done in non-real time.
Mm-hmm. Well, last week you did your first public performance together with Ian Boddy.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Oh, it was great. First of all, Ian's a friend and very talented musician. And we had not managed to connect across the 7,000-mile divide. So this was a rare opportunity, and he came out just for that. He's hoping that what we get out of it is releasable as an album. We recorded the show, and we recorded the rehearsals, or at least one of the rehearsals, and also did a living room concert with John DiLiberto. So hopefully out of all of that, we have some material that we can edit and mix for another album release that'll be a live album. The challenge working with him was to come up with all new material, or at least variations on old stuff, and to have it be as live and played as possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Having collaborated with Ian, do you see that as affecting your solo work in the future?
Well, you know, it's funny. Every collaboration, I think, when it works well, becomes a third person. Becomes something completely different from anything that you would do solo, or hopefully that the other person would do solo. Those things end up standing on their own. There are times when you find new vocabulary elements. I think in the case with Ian, we both brought in things that we had in mind to bring to that collaboration. So I'm not sure to what extent it's going to affect future work. I mean, we've each done several albums since the two that we've done. But, you know, I just love the fact that our two skill sets are complementary. I think that his skill set is very strong in terms of using the modern software tools, plugins, and sound design elements of, you know, some of those software tools, which I also get into, but to be honest, I tend to be more inspired by the hardware or the slightly more physical side of sound making. And so between the two approaches, I think we met in a really nice center space.
Mm-hmm. When you say physical, can you give an example of what you mean by that?
Well, like most of the rhythms on both albums came from the modular synth running different clock dividers, and so physical in this case, something with knobs and wires, you know, mm-hmm, an outboard. Mm-hmm. Whereas often, you know, his sounds were coming from really interesting sounds that he had created for, well, you know, his other source of income from music is doing libraries, sample libraries. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we would use some of the sounds that he had created or kept aside from those.
Mm-hmm.
And
try to release those before the libraries get used.
You know, that's, yeah, you can sort of take claim to the sound, and then, you know, if you do it first on an album, then somebody else uses the sound you have on a library, and you can poke at, you know, you poke fun at it and say, I did that sound, you see. 2 years ago, it was on this album. Just, yeah. We both do a bit of that sound design thing for income, and so we kind of poke fun at the process a little bit.
Can you give us some insight into some projects you have coming out in the future?
Well, to be honest, I'm still spinning from the things that just came out weeks ago. And being on tour to support those releases, I haven't even had time to think about what I'm going to do next. just days before I left on this tour, I had a new CD come out called Illumination, which is the score to a video installation in New York City by a video artist named Michael Somaroff. And that is up this summer until August at a gallery on the corner of 10th Avenue and 26th Street called Bravenly Programs. It's beautiful, slow-moving, large projection video with my music running in the whole room. There's five different video pieces, each with their own musical piece. And since they're in the same space, the musical pieces sort of work together, and they're all related harmonically with each other. And there's a lot of dissonance. It has a sound a little bit like Ligeti, you know, like the pieces people might be familiar with from 2001 A Space Odyssey, you know, that kind of clouds and clusters of pitches. And it's definitely on the darker, more static side of what I do, because it's purpose-made music to go with these very slow-moving graphics. And beyond that, I don't know, my next solo album might be a year away, so I think we'll probably just focus on the things that I'm still trying to figure out what to finish.
Once again, you seem to have this recurring theme of working with movies and something visual.
Well, oddly enough, that's a recent theme for me, because except for the occasional income project of doing sound design for a Hollywood film, most of my music is really done without visuals. And I find that the tension between those two things is interesting. I've avoided visuals for a long time because I think music is something that can stand on its own. When you close your eyes, you can make your own visuals. And if the music is evocative enough, it helps you create a movie in your mind. And I think when the music serves an existing visual, it leaves less for internal activity, and it becomes a little bit more of a given thing, more complete in the sense of what people are digesting, but I think in some ways limiting as far as what they can get out of it by putting into it, if mm-hmm. you know what I mean.
How does Stalker fit into that?
Well, Stalker, we're just using the metaphor that is used in the film by Andrei Tarkowski, and we wanted to make music that's taking people through a zone of unknowability, a place that's unmappable. And so the metaphor is borrowed from the film where a person guides these searchers into a zone where things keep changing. But beyond that, it's not meant as an alternate soundtrack. It's meant as a journey in the mind.
Okay, so it's an influence on the music, or an inspiration for the music.
Inspiration would be a good word, yeah. Okay. Definitely the film inspired the title. And the idea of journey through a zone.
Okay. I think many people might have that misconception.
Right.
Thinking that it is an alternate soundtrack.
Right. And there's no need for that. The soundtrack in Stalker is quite strong as it is, I think. And so,
okay. Yeah. Well, good luck tomorrow on your solo spot.
Thank you very much.
Nice talking to you again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, Bill.
I hope you enjoyed the interview. Please send comments about this podcast to info@wdiy.org. And remember to go there this Thursday at 11:04 p.m. in the Eastern U.S. time zone and listen to Galactic Travels. Until then, may peace and contentment be yours.